Welcome back to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and physics students from local high schools and beyond. Interns spend 2 weeks working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the prominent physicists who are here. I'm Marisa Walbert, and I'm hosting today's episode, which is being recorded here at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our intern today is Henry Billinghurst, who's a rising senior at Summit County High School. And he will be interviewing Krishna Rajagopal. After growing up in Toronto, Krishna Rajagopal did his undergraduate work at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. He obtained his doctorate at Princeton University in 1993 and spent 3 years at Harvard as a junior fellow. He then spent 1 year at Caltech before coming to MIT in 1997. He became the associate head of the Department of Physics in 2009, served as the chair of the MIT faculty from 2015 to 2017, and as MIT's dean for digital learning from 2017 to 2021. Professor Rajagopal studies matter at temperatures that are so high that quarks and gluons do not coalesce into protons or nuclei. Understanding hot quark soup requires linking particle and nuclear physics, cosmology, astrophysics, condensed matter physics, and string theory. Heavy ion collisions at RHIC and LHC recreate droplets of hot quark soup that filled the microseconds old universe, a soup that is called quark gluon plasma. Understanding its properties and emergence from QCD, the theory of how quarks interact, is a central challenge. Rajagopal uses holographic duality, perturbative QCD, and hydrodynamics to model how jets and heavy ion collisions are modified as they pass through hot quark soup, and how the wakes they created in the liquid relax, identifying how jet measurements probe its microscopic structure and rapid hydrodynamic formation. Longer term, he seeks to learn how strongly coupled liquid emerges from QCD paralleling challenges in condensed matter physics. He has also analyzed the QCD critical point, its hydrodynamics and fluctuations, proposed experimental signatures, and shown how RHIC energy scans search for it. Take it away, Henry.
Good morning, Radio Physics. Henry here. It's a pleasure. It's a beautiful morning here in Aspen. How are you?
I am well. Good morning, Henry. Good morning, Marisa.
Great. It's wonderful to be here. So, spoke a little bit about your research. I was wondering if you could go into that, what you are most proud of, I think.
Well, so Marisa set that up with her generous introduction. So I study hot quark soup is the one-line version. I'm interested in quarks and in all the different kinds of matter that quarks can make. So in the world around us, quarks make protons. But at the centers of neutron stars, protons are crushed into a sort of a cold quark soup. You know, quark soup is not what it's called in the scientific literature, but it's actually a good name. So I study both hot and cold quark soup. I think what I'm proud of is, in many ways, the ways that understanding the properties of this matter connect across very, very different areas of physics. It's cosmology, because where did hot quark soup exist? It was in the Big Bang. The whole universe was filled with hot quark soup for the first 10 microseconds of its existence. And then at 10 microseconds old, the universe, this soup fell apart into a mist of protons. And that's when protons formed for the first time. So one of the things I'm doing is studying the matter that filled the universe when it was 10 microseconds old. That's cosmology. The centers of neutron stars, that's the only place you can make cold quark soup. Hmm. So that's astrophysics. Quarks, how do you study quarks? That's particle physics. Particle and nuclear physics. Where string theory comes in is these kinds of gases are easy to understand. Actually, crystals are not that hard to understand. Liquids are actually very difficult to understand. And the fact that nature, that we've learned from these experiments at RIC in the United States and the LHC at CERN in Geneva, we've learned from these experiments that the early universe was filled with a soup of quark, so a liquid. That makes it very hard to understand from first principles theoretical calculations. And what string theory has given us is a set of calculational tools that allow us to rigorously analyze how liquids made up of charged particles, so liquids made up of quarks, how they behave. So I like making these connections between fields. A lot of the advances that I'm most proud of have come from recognizing something from condensed matter physics that I can apply to quarks, or recognizing something from string theory that I can use over here, or recognizing something over here that has an implication over there. So a lot of what I do involves making connections.
It's fantastic.
But I could say a little bit about the jets that were in Maurice's introduction, if you'd like.
Yeah, please.
I think at this sort of point in our understanding of the subject, we've learned, no one was expecting a liquid. The first heavy ion collisions that recreated the Big Bang were around the year 2000 at RIC in New York, Brookhaven, Long Island. By 2005, it was clear that this was not a evanescent, a gaseous plasma, that this was a soup. So we've known now for 20 years that the early universe was filled with hot quark soup, which hot quark soup is what I like to call it. The quark gluon plasma is what you'll see if you read the scientific literature.
Sure.
That's a really tremendous discovery. It comes from the combination of theoretical physics, from hydrodynamics, and fundamentally from these experiments, from these collider physics experiments. But that's 2005. So any time in science when you make a great discovery, one of the things that makes it great is that it opens new questions. Mm-hmm. And the questions that we've been wrestling with since around 2005 include, how does this liquid form so quickly? How does it ripple and flow? If you have a liquid and you can, if you drive a boat through a lake, it makes waves. So how do the waves in this liquid behave? And how on earth can the fundamental laws of quarks, which are called QCD, how can a liquid emerge from those laws? One of the great overarching problems, I think, for the 21st century in physics is this question of emergence. We have simple laws. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever seen, you can get a t-shirt or a coffee mug with the standard model of particle physics on a coffee mug or a t-shirt. So the laws can be, the fundamental laws can be written down in considerable brevity. And yet, what do those laws describe? Look around us. They describe tables. They describe air. They describe metals, insulators, magnets, superconductors. And that's just materials. Then you go on from materials to chemistry. You go on from chemistry to biology. So how does complexity, the world is certainly complex, even starting from materials. Materials are complex. How do complex materials come out of simple laws? That's a great question. It's an overarching question. And this hot quark soup is a chance for us to answer it, at least in this context, because hot quark soup is complex. There are ways in which it is the simplest form of complex matter we know.
Okay.
It's not as complex as what our condensed matter physics colleagues study when they look at high temperature superconductors or the things that we heard about in the colloquium at the Aspen Center for Physics yesterday. It's not as complex as that, but it has many of the same elements of complexity that all the challenges of modern condensed matter physics have, and yet it is very, very close to simplicity. It's close to the fundamentals. These were the first complex things that ever formed in the universe, protons were. So the challenge of understanding the emergence of a complex liquid from fundamental laws is the other sort of driving question that animates this field for the past 20 plus years. And everything I just said, one of the best ways of sort of teasing this out from experiment is to shoot a bullet through the liquid and see how is the bullet deflected and how do you get waves in the liquid? How do the waves in the liquid behave? So the bullets are called jets. You collide two nuclei. I'm talking with my hands. The radio audience can't see me talking with my hands, but I collide two nuclei. You can imagine my hands slamming together and clapping like that. I collide two nuclei. That makes a drop of soup. But in the same collision where I make a blob of soup, I have two quarks collide at high energy and scatter at large angles. And now I have two quarks shooting through this liquid. So you make the liquid and you make the two bullets all in the same collision. Those, when you have a single quark with very high energy, what happens in QCD is that it fragments into a spray of particles. You can think of like a conical spray.
Okay.
That's called a jet. And that's very, very well studied, very well understood when all of that is happening in the vacuum. But when you have this jet going through the soup, you now have this bullet that is this jet all the particles in the jet are fighting their way through the soup. Some of them will get deflected. That's the scattering experiment. The way you study the structure of matter is you have like an electron microscope. You shoot an electron through the material and see how the electrons get deflected. This is like that. But at the same time that the jet is being deflected and it's losing energy, you can think of it as like friction. It's making waves in the liquid. And last year, for the first time, we had a clean, unambiguous, experimental detection of the waves. In my view, I think we have seen evidence for the waves for about 5 years already. Mm-hmm. But everything that I could point to and say, I think that in the data is coming from the waves, somebody else could say, oh no, I have another explanation. But last year, actually, from this particular measurement came from the Large Hadron Collider, the CMS collaboration at the Large Hadron. So we can see the waves. We can start to see the deflection of the particles in the jet. So we can start to now probe the inner structure, the microscopic structure of this liquid to understand how it's formed. How does it emerge from fundamental laws? We can start to look and see how it responds. How do these waves dissipate? So we're starting now to have the tools to really answer the questions that the discovery of the 2000 to 2005 period, that when we discovered that the fundamental primordial matter that the universe was formed out of is a liquid. That was the discovery of 20 years ago, and now we're really at the point of understanding that liquid. That's sort of where we are right now.
That's fantastic. You were speaking a little bit about the waves and this hot quark soup.
Yeah.
If we could predict kind of how those looked in the very early universe, could that account for some of like the randomness we see in the distribution of matter nowadays?
That's an awesome question. I wish the answer were yes. Unfortunately, there's a great mismatch in length scales. Mm. So first of all, we don't have jets in the early universe, but let's just pretend for a second that something somewhere happened in the very early universe when it was 1 microsecond old that made waves in the liquid.
Right.
Okay. Those waves will spread and dissipate and die out over a length scale that is, so the size of a proton, let me give you a sense of, the size of a proton is 10 to the minus 15 meters.
Right.
Okay. And those waves will spread out and dissipate and die away over a length scale that's probably between 10 to the minus 14 and 10 to the minus 13 meters.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah. So that's a long length scale compared to the size of a proton.
Sure.
But it's a very, very short length scale on the scale of cosmology. If you had some way of making ripples back at that microsecond time scale that were, say, 100 meters long,
mm-hmm.
Are 100 meters in size, then as the universe expands, that those might survive and might have consequences, the formation of galaxies much, much later in the universe. 100 meters, a kilometer, 10 kilometers, those are the, if you had disturbances on those scales,
right,
they'll influence later cosmology in a way that can be seen today with telescopes. But when you have disturbances that are 10 to the minus 13 meters, they dissipate, die away, and long before anything like galaxies form, long before anything that our cosmology colleagues can see with telescopes. So I wish the answer were yes, but this is a case where it's a pretty clear no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I appreciate that. Is there like a favorite?
And so the flip side of it is the following. Cosmologists with telescopes can answer certain questions about the early universe. Okay. The visible matter is only 5% of the universe. Dark matter is 20-something percent. Dark energy is three quarters of the energy budget of the universe. Nothing that I do addresses those questions. So mm-hmm. There's a set of things that we learn about cosmology from observing galaxies and redshifts and the microwave background radiation, all the things that you observe today with amazing telescopes.
Mm.
But there's a set of questions that they have no way of addressing.
Right.
If you ask, what's the material properties of this stuff that filled the early universe? Does it behave like a gas or does it behave like a liquid? They have no way of actually answering that question.
Hmm.
So what we've answered from our side is more like the material science, what this stuff of the early universe, how does it feel as a material? Okay.
Sure.
That's what we've answered. And because of this mismatch of length scales, that's a question that you have to answer on the length scales that are the natural length scales of the material, which are more of these 10 to the minus 15 meters, 10 to the minus 14 meters, 10 to the minus 13 meter length scales, not the meters, kilometers, light years, time scales. I mean, length scales, excuse me.
Is there a favorite project that you've worked on in the field of QCD that you'd like to share with us?
Always one's favorite project is what you're working on right now.
Oh, well then go by all means.
And as we've been talking about what I'm working on right now, so I would say if I go back, I'll point to a couple of things that we haven't talked about. One is work that I did in around, say, 1997, 1998, 1999, 2000, in that range, about cold quark soup, which we haven't talked about. So if you take nuclei and crush them to very high densities, but not in a collision at an accelerator, because if you do it in a collision at an accelerator, you have so much energy, you make a very hot soup. But if you have a way of crushing them without heating them up, you get a very different kind of matter. And the only way that we can do that in the laboratory, but nature does it by building a neutron star, the centers of neutron stars are maybe 10 times denser than nuclei. Mm-hmm. So the nuclei are neutron star centers. The heaviest known neutron stars, which are about twice the mass of the sun, very likely at their centers, the protons and neutrons are crushed into a fluid of quarks. That liquid of quarks is kind of like the electrons in a metal. That's the right, if you're thinking of a familiar material to start thinking, that's the right starting point. There is no crystal structure. It's as if you just had the electrons in a metal and not the ionic crystal, except it's not electrons, it's quarks. And what do we know about electrons in a metal? Well, we know that they can form a superconductor. And superconductivity in metals is a very, very delicate thing. And the reason is that what we know is to get superconductivity, if you have electrons in a metal, to get superconductivity, they have to attract each other. And you learn in high school that electrons are all negatively charged, so they repel each other. So how on earth can electrons in a metal attract each other? And there is an answer. It comes from solid-state physics. It's not quarks, and it relies on crystal lattice. So a metal is a liquid of electrons and a crystal lattice. And the vibrations in the crystal lattice can give you an attraction between electrons, which is it's a delicate thing. It is so much easier with quarks because quarks attract each other. Okay, so I've got quarks at high density in the center of a neutron star. Hey, wait a minute, they just attract each other. It's not delicate. I don't need to stand on my head and have a crystal lattice. And quarks attract each other. And so what we realized, there were two groups that came to this realization at the same time independently. One was Mark Alford, Frank Wilczek, and myself. And what we realized is that superconductivity in the quark matter in the center of a neutron star is, it's robust. It's guaranteed. You know, it's not like you have to find special materials and go to special conditions. If there's quark matter in a neutron star, it will be a superconductor. Over the few years after that, we sort of worked out the properties of this superconductivity. Quarks are more complicated than electrons in some ways, and in particular, there's different flavors of quarks. You have to figure out who pairs with whom. That was sort of a very exciting set of developments that I'm very proud of, however many years it is later. Not quite, more than 25 years later. But the second one that I'll say a few more words about, and this again, this has to do with, I think, thinking about the style of how you do theoretical physics. Regardless of what your topic is, there are different styles of making progress in theoretical physics. There are some people, and this could be in astrophysics, it could be in condensed matter physics or particle physics, it doesn't matter the field. There are some people who do very, very difficult calculations. At any moment in history, there's a set of things that people know how to do, and then there's things that are too difficult.
Right.
And there's some people who make their advances by being the first one to do something that everyone else thought was too difficult. Okay? I've never done that. I've never done a theoretical physics calculation that was thought to be difficult.
Really?
So the way I've made progress always has been not by doing something difficult, but by making a connection that nobody had seen. So, hey, wait a minute, quarks should be superconducting. Okay, that's an example. Superconductivity is about solids. Quarks are particle physics. Mark and Frank and I realized that given what we know from the theory of electrons in a solid, quarks have to be superconducting. If you can make cold quark soup in a neutron star, it's a superconductor. Okay, that was not hard. It was not a difficult calculation. It was a realization that came from connecting things. So the other example I'll give you, around about 2003, new colleague came to MIT. So I had arrived in 97, that's 6 years later. New faculty member arrived. And in fact, he's coming here to the Aspen Center for Physics next week. His name is Hong Lu. Okay, my young colleague Hong Lu, we're both less young now. my young colleague Hong Lu arrives and he's in the office next to me. He's a string theorist. He starts telling me about these, me and other, you know, it's just normal lunch table conversation. He starts telling me about these new developments in string theory. There's ADS CFT, and there's these duality, and there's holographic duality, which Marisa mentioned. And it had nothing to do with what anything I knew about, okay? And I could have, one could have not paid attention, okay? But I try to be curious. So this has nothing to do with what I work on, but I've got a new colleague. I'm curious. And so I learn in his context, I'm learning what he's doing. He's telling me about the things. There's a set of things in strongly coupled systems that we know how to calculate with these new tricks from string theory and holography and duality and gauge theories become black holes in five dimensions. Wow, this is cool. But surely it's not relevant to anything I actually care about in my world. But it doesn't matter. I'm listening. I'm curious. And so I think this curiosity is really key. You run into something new, you're curious about it because I had no idea in 2003 that was going to happen. It's going to happen. Anyway, I'm listening. Enough to have a sense of the curiosity and have a sense of what Hong's doing. But this is pie in the sky, string theory, not relevant to the real world of quark gluon plasma. Then in 2005, I'm sitting in a conference, like a big conference, 600 people. Mm. I'm somewhere in the audience, and the speaker is a theoretical physicist from CERN named Urs Wiedemann. And Urs is giving a talk about jets in quark gluon plasma, which we talked about a minute ago.
Right.
And Urs is saying, so I've got this great calculational framework for calculating how a jet is affected by quark gluon plasma. You've got this jet. How does it get affected by the quark gluon plasma? And he said, what you boil it down to is this Wilson loop. And, we'd really like to know how to calculate this Wilson loop, but we don't know how to calculate it. But the progress is that I've turned this problem of how does a jet get modified into the question of how do you calculate a Wilson loop? And I practically jumped out of my seat because this new young professor, Hong Lu, had one of the things he had told me, which I had been paying enough attention to have remembered, was, hey, one of the things we know how to do is to calculate Wilson loops.
Huh.
Okay? So I literally left the hall and I phoned Hong from, it's a conference in Santa Fe. I phoned Hong from the hallway outside and said, Hong, I just heard this talk by Urs Wiedemann, whom Hong doesn't know Urs. He's a great physicist from my side, and he just said da 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 da. And these Wilson loops for him are Wilson loops that are light-like. Have you ever calculated light-like Wilson loops with these new methods of yours? And Hong said, well, no. We've calculated space-like Wilson loops, and we've calculated time-like Wilson loops, but nobody thought light-like Wilson loops were interesting. And I said, well, and he said, but it'll be easy. Okay. So by the end of the week, Hong and Urs and I were talking, and we had calculated the light-like Wilson loop. Urs had said, to understand jets, you need to calculate this light-like Wilson loop. We had calculated it. So that was really fun. That realization that these new tools that were discovered by string theorists for their own reasons were useful in my field, that was that one moment in that conference. For me, that discovery was that one moment. I ended up working with Hong and Urs for a number of years. We wrote a bunch of papers together. I still work with Urs. I still talk with Hong. Hong's office is still right next to mine. Hong, Urs, and I, and two co-authors, in 2014, we wrote a book.
Mm-hmm.
I've never written any other books in my career. Normally, we write papers. That book was about let's teach string theory to quark gluon plasma people. Let's teach quark gluon plasma to string theory people. So the first 200 pages was a 100-page introduction to string theory for my community, and then a 100-page introduction to quark gluon plasma for his community. That's the first half of the book. The second half of the book was all of the applications of these string theory-derived methods in our field. We laid them all out, talked about how everything was done. So this moment in 2005, which I was prepared for because when my new colleague arrived, I didn't blow him off.
Right.
What he was doing was not related to what I knew, but it was. I was curious about it. That curiosity, I think, is what has led to all of my advances. So I just talked about this example at length because it's a good story. You know, the other thing to generalize from this is it's all about people. In my experience, it's my students, it's my collaborators, it's everything I do. It's in some way how it originates is some interaction between people. How do you make a connection? You make a connection by having a conversation and being curious about what other people are doing and listening and taking your one and my one and putting them together, and one plus one ends up being five.
Sure.
If you don't pay attention to the other person's one, you'll never see it.
Hmm. That's beautiful. I really, really appreciate that. It's incredible.
There are some students who get really excited about quarks and the Higgs boson and the Large Hadron Collider. There are some students who get really, really excited about extrasolar planets or about cosmology. So what excites you? You want to pick something in a domain where you find the big picture science questions really exciting, because if you're going to spend a semester in a lab, you'll be surrounded by people who are poking at this big picture, and you want it to be something that excites you. Okay, this is obvious to any student. Any student, this is number one, and every student already thinks of this. You don't need me to say this. Number two, which students don't think about necessarily, is what's the labor? Okay, you in that lab are going to be working. What's the work? Because to have those moments like I described, you've done an enormous amount of work before that. So what's the work? It might be plugging leaks in a vacuum system. It might be getting the laser, brand new laser arrived in a box. Get that laser out of a box. Get it installed. Figure out how to connect it to power. Get it aligned. Getting it aligned might take you 3 months. Mm-hmm. Get that laser installed and working on the optical bench. Get everything set up to start doing the optics you wanted to do. That's work. Mm-hmm. It might be doing integrals. It might be writing code. So what's the work? The work has to be something you like doing. You don't do science if you don't like the work you're doing. Mm-hmm. And some people like doing integrals. Some people like writing code. Some people like soldering a circuit together. Some people like plugging leaks in a vacuum system. The work should be something you're proud of. You got that laser working, you should be proud of that. Mm-hmm. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is the project is some big research project that your faculty member and maybe a much larger group than that has defined the larger agenda. You as an undergrad are not responsible for defining the big picture. But somewhere in that big picture, there has to be a thing that is yours. You as an undergrad have to take agency for achieving something, doing something, getting it finished, delivering it. It could be a piece of software. It could be a plot. It could be a data analysis. There has to be some piece that is your responsibility. So when you go visit that professor, you're asking, is the big picture exciting? What's the work I have to do? And is there something here that's mine? If all that happens is that you learn a ton about the big picture, that's great, but that wasn't research, okay?
Right.
But that's not a research project. For it to be a real research experience as an undergrad, there has to be something that was your responsibility. Those are the three.
That's awesome. I really appreciate that. All right. Well, we know that time is relative, but time also runs short. But it's been a pleasure talking to you, Christian, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and learn some great information.
Henry, this has been great. Real pleasure meeting you, and I wish you all the best in whatever your future scientific endeavors are. And thank you very much, Marisa, to you and to the Center.